My message today, as you know, we've been going through the book of the Gospel of John. I think it's been five or six messages now that we've done on that one. I could continue, I think, with one or two more, but the story in the Gospel of John, from where I left off, it moves into the passion of Jesus, if you will, the crucifixion. And we just had a message on that. So after that, there's a few more encounters that maybe two more or three more encounters that we could touch, that we could look at, that have to do with Jesus coming back after being raised from the dead and meeting his disciples. But even those have been talked about and touched on in the recent messages. So I have decided to leave that series, to leave that where it is, and bring that to an end. In addition to that, James also came and told me that he might be encroaching on my territory in the Gospel of John. So it's all yours, James. I'm going to leave it there. In my studies this week, or in my seeking this week, I was going back and forth. I had a whole list of things. Nothing really was coming to me. Nothing seemed to fit. I've known for a while that I want to do a deeper study into a book in the Bible again, similar to what I did with the Epistle of John a couple years ago. And I couldn't quite settle on anything until yesterday morning. I think God opened something up to me. So, Lord willing, we'll attempt to do an introduction of sorts into the book of Paul's letter to the Romans. And today will just be an introductory sort of message into that. When I think of that topic or that book, I don't know if I recall anybody here ever preaching even one message out of there. Probably there has been some, but I couldn't quite think of anything. So I feel that it's a void in my knowledge of the Word. I have on multiple occasions personally purpose to, and this is just for me personally, to spend some time in Romans to kind of dig in, to take it apart, to analyze it. It is a very nuts and bolts sort of book, very doctrinal, very theological. And for whatever reason, I would start and I would read through it a few days in my devotions, and I would move on to something else. I haven't spent much time in the book of Romans in my life. Let's put it that way. So if you're new to it, if you're the same way, then we'll go through it and we'll learn together, hopefully. And part of my drive part of my desire for taking on another book instead of doing a topic or something, is I was reading in, I have a little booklet at home. I think I got it from Anthony. It's a collection of essays titled Challenges and Opportunities Within Conservative Anabaptism. And it's five different authors touching on the topic of school, of business, of home, of church, and of missions. And under the church heading, under the write-up on the Anabaptist church, the direction over the next 25 years, the problems, our vision in that, the author highlights a problem. Well, he would probably say it's a problem in our groups where Anabaptists have traditionally been focused on right living as opposed to right theology or right doctrine. And he says that we could do better as a people, as people groups, as churches. We could do better. We could improve on the area of theology, of each of us being taught and being learned and being able to explain and able to take apart and to analyze and to teach others the subject or the area of some of this deeper theology and doctrinal issues. So I see that again as a need in my life. I see that as a void in my spectrum of knowledge of the word. So that is some of the motivation behind what I want to get into this morning. We're told in Scripture we need to be ready to give answer for the hope that lies within. I know from my own personal experience that, you know, we often say that the person preparing the message, the person doing the teaching, you do so much study into something and you try to condense it down into 20 minutes. So I know that I'll be blessed through this. I hope that the church can be blessed as well. I know that putting in the time, digging into the word will be a blessing to me. I trust that the Lord will bless the church through that as well. So like I said, I've only settled on this topic yesterday. I don't know if I'll even use all my time. I don't have a very long introduction prepared. I was kind of struggling all week. I came down sick on Sunday and was even off work, I think Wednesday or Thursday. But the Lord, trust the Lord will provide, that the Lord will feed his church. This sort of thing requires discipline for me. In that collection of essays that I was talking about, that's one of the challenges that's highlighted, is because it takes work, it takes labor, it takes digging in. It's not the easiest thing to do to take a set of doctrines and to break them apart and to study and to dive deep and to really settle these questions in our hearts. So it will take discipline for me and maybe for us to go through this. So I think to start off with, I want to answer the question of who. Who was this book written to? And to do that, I'm going to take actually a bit of time to do this. I want to paint a picture for us of the era of this period of time, of what was going on in the world, some of the things that were happening. And I think to do that, I want to draw a bit of a map on the board. This would be a fun message to do with a projector, but we don't have that. I'm going to attempt here to draw, and this is going to be the Mediterranean Sea. Hopefully it's not too bad that we can't make that out. So this is here. I need to be careful of my scale too, because I need to have certain things in here. This would be Greece. And over here we have, this would be Israel. And then we go across to Northern Africa. There's a little bump down here, and then it comes up. And modern day Tunisia is in here. Is that dark enough? I think you can see that. And then it snakes off over here underneath Spain. And then we have the cowboy boot here of Italy. And something else here, maybe. And then way out there, we would have the ocean. And then the UK. Then we have Turkey jutting in here, and sort of, this is very rough, but there's sort of another body of water up here, the Black Sea. So this rough shape that I drew. It's the Mediterranean Sea. Greece is over here. Italy's over here. Rome is over here. Israel's over here on this side. I could label some of these, I guess. We have Northern Africa. Let's just write that on the bottom. We'll put Rome right there. I think there's a bit of a divide here or something. And I believe Corinth would be something like that. And these names all, these places have changed and traded hands, and I'm going off of a modern map here. But during this time, and again, I said it's interesting, your character that you chose, Nick, but during this time, there was an empire that had sprung up. It didn't spring up. The Roman Empire lasted for a very long time. The exact span of time, I think basically, when did it collapse? In 472 AD, I think. I don't know if I have that written in here. But I believe I'm going to draw a timeline over here too. So here's the middle. This is BC, AD, and right in the middle here, I think it's in the year 3 or 4 AD where Jesus was born. And let's say that this is 500 here, and this is 500 before Christ. According to the studies that I've came across, or to the write-ups, the Roman Empire stretched up till around 470 AD, and I think some of that was like half the empire, because this side was taken back by the Germanic people from the top, and then this side here collapsed later. But we're right here in this story. That's where we're taking a look. That's where we're going to be diving in. That's when the book of Romans was written. And we have to realize that the Roman Empire didn't just start here. It actually started, and there's some disputes here, I think. It's not exactly clear. I mean, when do you call something an empire, right? You have a city-state starting, and then it grows a little bigger. It takes on another one, and then maybe it loses a war here, and then it gains a country there. So at some point, you can call it's no longer really just a city-state anymore. This thing is growing, and this thing is becoming an empire, right? So I don't know where exactly to peg that, but I saw dates like 200 BC for starting dates for the Roman Empire. I saw different dates that were way earlier. I'm no expert on this. This is a couple of hours of me diving in and doing some research. I'm no expert on this. But the Roman Empire was a very strong presence at this time. It was probably not the peak of their power, but it was, I don't know if it was very far off. I think in the first or second century would have been kind of the most area that they had, or the most powerful. Somewhere in here would have been their most powerful point, I believe. So we were somewhere in that range. And for me, it was interesting to note this. Yes, I knew that the Romans got as far west here as the UK and as London, but I actually didn't realize that only, like right in here, like I think 10 years before the book of Romans was written, the Romans were already pushing into the UK. They were already taking over territories up there. They were already being established across the English Channel. That's how big this was. This empire stretched, I think if I would draw it roughly, During right here, during this time, they would have had parts of this. They would have had chunks of this. They would have had kind of the edges along here. They had some of this, I think. I think there were maybe I think there was somebody else involved up here too. Basically, as Nick pointed out earlier, this was the boss of the world, pretty much. If you were the emperor of the Roman Empire, you were over a whole lot of territory. I understand that this area covered what would be 40 different countries today, the span of the Roman Empire. Now again, I don't know exactly how many of those, this is a moving thing, okay? It grew out of here, it grew bigger here, then they took some of this, then they took some of that, and they kept pushing out, and growing and shrinking, and then they would do a war here, and then they would get overtaken by somebody else, and then they lost a little bit. But they had a lot of area in that first century. They had a big empire in the first century during the time of Jesus, during the time when the letter to the Romans was written. Oh, I have it written down. 43 AD is when the Romans invaded Britain, all the way across the channel there. I have a map here. Again, a projector would be good. But I have a map that somebody put together estimating how long it would take to travel to some of these places from Rome. So just to give us a bit of an idea, you could get from Rome to Greece in about 7 days. So you realize this body of water here, the Mediterranean Sea, this was the freeway. This was the interstate system for this empire. This is what allowed them to get 100 boats together, go across and surprise these guys and take over some of these lands. This body of water is what made travel possible. Just to give you an example, from here to here on the map is probably not much different than from here to here on the map. But this took 28 days according to this chart, and this was 2 weeks to get to. Because you had to go over so much land and you had to jump in a boat again, or I think you could also go through this way, right? I think this is open. Yeah. This is actually like that, to the ocean. So this body of water is what enabled a lot of this empire spread to be possible. And any travel that you had to do, that you wanted to do, if you could go by boat, it was probably your best bet. In studying this time period, what struck me is how modern a time this is. I could relate to a lot of what I was reading. I could relate to a lot of things that were going on. Because, and there's probably a few reasons for that, but one of the reasons would be the system of government. We live in a democratic system today. We have elections. We elect leaders today. There was something similar in place back then. We don't have a king. I guess we do have a king, but on paper. But they were under a similar government system as we are. And of course, there's differences. But in a sense, I could relate to a lot of this, to a lot of the maneuvering and the politicking and the logistics of it all, if you will. So I get the impression that this is quite a modern time. It must have been a very exciting time to be alive. because if you look at the Roman army for a minute, and this was a force to be reckoned with. I don't know how many people were enlisted, how many soldiers were enlisted at this time, at any time, but this was maybe the, and I'm just throwing this, I don't know, I didn't look this up, but this was possibly the largest organization of people in history to that point. Would that be fair to say? I'm not sure. But to think of the scale of organizing a military without our modern day technologies, without fast communication, without gas engines, without electronics, this would have had to be a very advanced civilization. Very organized, very driven, very modern is the word that came to my mind. When you look at the Roman military, I was looking up how long people had to enlist when they enlisted in the army. I think at first it started out shorter, maybe 10 years or 15 years, but I think eventually they made it so that you had to commit for 25 years to the army if you were going into the army in Rome. And during that time, they were not allowed to marry, legally speaking at least. But I'm sure there was a lot of working around that, if you will. They were paid, I think they got a salary, but they were paid sometimes with land. When they finished their time of service, they would be given a pretty generous chunk of land, I understand. Or other times, I think they would be able to get the loot that came out of the people that they conquered. A soldier could have servants under himself. And I didn't do a whole lot of study into this. I've listened to some podcasts in the past, and there's probably whole books and whole studies on just the topic of the Roman army. But if you just think for a minute about the logistics of some of this, about moving 5,000 people, for example, from here to here, and then having a war up here once you get there, think of what all has to be involved with that. I think a legion was 5,000 people. I think they were organized in groups of 8 and then 12. I'm going to get it wrong now. And then those 8 grouped into bigger groups and bigger groups until you got to a legion which was over 5,000 people, I understand. And now, how much food does it take to feed 5,000 people every day, 3 times a day? How about if you need to move those 5,000 people, their leaders, their cows and their sheep that they're going to eat tonight, their weapons, their baggage, their tents, their tools, to, I don't know where they're going, to conquer the Germans, the Germanic people up north, or to put all that onto ships and move them 2 weeks away. Think of the logistics of what's involved with that. Think of the amount of planning of resources needed to fund this and to make this possible. I did some quick searches at home this morning. It doesn't even make sense. Maybe I won't even say that. Imagine standing beside a road and watching this 5,000 people marching down the road. Behind them, there's their tents and their baggage and their equipment and their... the reason I said it doesn't make sense is because one estimate was 20 minutes to pass, but somewhere else I read that it could take 8 hours for the whole thing to pass you. And I don't know, the 20 minutes to me seems short. But if this thing stretches out for, I don't know, how many miles is this? If you're walking 4 wide times 5,000, if there's the space between you, there's there's stuff, there's baggage carts, there's all sorts of things moving. And then as soon as the first people arrive at the next campsite, I guess they're starting to build. I read in one place that they would build wooden forts for their campsites, set up their defenses, build their forts, start making food. And in the meantime, this chain is still, the end of the snake, if you will, is still coming in. And they're already having to build the provisions for that night's rest. It's mind-boggling, the planning and the organization behind this machine. From the very beginning, I understand that their navy, navy being their fleet of the portion of the army that's in this, that's in here, that's in the water. I understand that their navy was not much until maybe here, when, and some of you history people might have to help me out. What, who's the group of people that came up this way with elephants? I don't know their names. Okay. I think after these wars, they decided they need to take their navy seriously and purpose to go and build some boats. And I think they built 100 ships then and established a strong presence in the Mediterranean Sea with the Roman navy. And this is still true in modern times. When you have a body of water like this, it can be treacherous to sail through it because everybody knows that everything that needs to move, they say that all roads lead to Rome, right? So everything that needs to move here, if there's a ship going this way, if there's a ship going that way, chances are there's wealth on there and there's valuables on there. And so there was piracy. And with the establishment of the Roman navy, this suppressed, if you will, the piracy that was going on, and it opened up the ability for people to move around and the ability for people to travel and for the empire to grow even more because commerce was able to flow freely back and forth because of the strong presence that the Roman navy had on the Mediterranean Sea to crush piracy and to do away with, to police the water, if you will. And we still see that today. The United States has been the police of the oceans, if you will, for probably since the Second World War. I understand that they're sort of retreating from some of that. They're changing their... there's one opinion that I listen to that makes the point that the United States is in the process of changing from smaller policing-style activities to big super carriers that can take out half a country. And that some of these activities will actually... minimize or at least decrease the globalization the way that we've come to know it, because this does open up again the ability for piracy, for illegal activities in the water. And we're seeing that underneath, where is it? Where the Houthi, what are they called? They're taking, they're seizing, the Iranians, I think, are seizing oil tankers and that sort of thing. And part of that is due to the U.S. sort of releasing their hold, if you will, of policing the oceans. So same thing, well, opposite thing was going on there. The Romans were growing their policing of the oceans. They were growing their presence. They were becoming more powerful. And again, this opened up things. This allowed somebody now, if you're part of the Roman Empire now over here, well, now you can all of a sudden probably pretty safely jump on a boat and make your way over to Rome and be there in a week. Look at all the opportunity that's now opened up for you. Whereas before, you might have encountered two different countries of pirates trying to take over your ship. So this is where we find ourselves here. It seems like an exciting time to be alive. The roads that these people built, probably a lot of you know this, there are still Roman roads in existence today. From here, you can find remainders of Roman roads to here. They're still roads that the Romans were built that people are, maybe they're not driving Super Bees on there, but they're walking them, they're driving their bikes. They are, I think there is some vehicular traffic actually on some of the Roman roads. Of course, they're probably maintained and whatever, but, and they're apparently very bumpy because the stones have worn down, and but they're still there. Their infrastructure that the Romans built is still around 2,000 years later. Again, it seems like a very modern time. Then we have the politics. I guess Nick didn't really touch on that, but the debauchery of the politics. We're used to some of that today. When there's elections, we're familiar with the smear campaigns and with the politicking that goes on. Well, it seems the Romans had this at another level. There's accounts of Nero, I think, was said to have poisoned his wife's brother, is it? Because there was talk of him taking his place or taking his power. There was all sorts of things going on. It was an evil time as well. I'll see it that way. There was a lot of debauchery, a lot of sinful lifestyle happening during that time. There was a lot of political maneuvering and pulling strings, and it's who you know. I know this guy that knows that guy can get this done. There's a lot of that sort of thing. Even though, well, we still see this today. We have the saying today, it's who you know, it's not what you know. Well, I can see a lot of that in the time of the Romans. It's said that the Roman laws and their court systems have served as the foundation for many countries' justice systems, such as the U.S. and a lot of Europe. I was looking at even their coins and some of the artifacts that are coming out of there. I saw pictures of coins and with very realistic faces. I've seen some older stuff that was kind of chipped away. You could kind of make out it might have been a face at one point. But I saw pictures of some of these Roman coins that were really nice, that were in really good shape. If I didn't know any better, I might have thought they were minted over on Lajimodier at the mint. They might have been stamped out by a machine there if I didn't know any better. They looked really good. Again, just to make the point that this was, in my mind, it was quite a modern time. And we already touched on that all of these trends, all of these happenings, all of these activities, they opened up travel in the Roman Empire. Now, I think I have I don't know if I brought my map of Paul's travels. I don't think so. I don't have the map of Paul's travels. But the letter to Romans was likely written during Paul's time in Corinth. Now, Corinth is in Greece over here. There's a couple cities here that he was in, that he spent time in. And he would have written the letter to go to here, right? That's Rome over there. The letter is said to be written in approximately 57 AD, so 57 years after Jesus' birth, to the church in Rome. So that's where we find ourselves. During the writing of this book, that's what was going on. That's what the world looked like. We have, of course, everything to the east, the Chinese, the Indians, they're doing their thing. They're somewhat, I get the impression they're disconnected from all of this. I guess there's a lot of land in between. but this was the Roman Empire. Now, in the letter to the church in Rome, we touched here on the when and the where question. of the book. To who was this book written and why? It's obviously written to the church in Rome, but at first, and maybe not at first glance, but once you get into a number of chapters in, there is a significant Jewish thread woven through the book of Romans. Why is that? When the Romans take over a country, there's war, and we know what happens in a war. Maybe it doesn't happen exactly like that today, but back then you had an army come in, and if you lost the war, well, a bunch of you are now slaves. Maybe we kill all the men and we take all the women and children back as slaves. Maybe some of the men make it back as well. But like we said before, all roads lead to Rome. So guess what happens with a lot of Israelites that are taken over by the Roman Empire? A lot of them make their way through this, through wars and slavery, into different parts of the empire, one of which being the city of Rome. It's estimated that there was a lot of Jews there in the city of Rome. At one point, and I think that is right around the beginning of the AD period, somebody estimated, in fact, there's more than one person that estimated that the population of the city, of the Jews in the city, was as high as 10%. So there is a lot of Jews around. The Jews are sort of spread out all over the place. We remember the accounts in the Bible of the exiles of the Jewish people. There was a bunch of them in the Babylonian area. I think there was some that were up here. There was a Jewish population in Egypt, I believe. There was Jews in Greece. There was a lot of Jews in Rome. It seems that the Jews were pretty spread out throughout the whole empire during that time. And not only because of wars, but also because of the freedoms that were now opened up by free travel across the Mediterranean Sea, there was opportunity now. And there was wealth now that could be gained by trading in some of these cities. So a lot of these migrations and the movements of the Jews were not only because of slavery, but they were also just because of people, you know, pursuing something better, pursuing a better way of life, going to there to make some money, and then doing this or that, moving around. A lot of these Jews that were taken as slaves, I think, maybe I'm mixing up my time periods here. I think a bunch of them were also, they had their slavery kind of bought out by other Jews, so they were freed. So there was a lot of Jews living in the empire, doing their thing, mixing in with the populations. I think sometimes they would have had their own quarters of town. There was already during this time some anti-Semitism that was going on. So that led to them being isolated in places. That also led them to, from what I gather, they had a relatively peaceful existence. And I think they were in Rome, actually, for 300 years already, some Jews. They were around, they were spread out already pretty far back. So when it comes up to here, yes, there was a lot here. They were probably already established. And I think they had a pretty peaceful time of it up till about here, or I think in 63 there was some persecution on the Jews. I don't have that one written down, but there was another one in 19 AD, an expulsion of the Jews, where the emperor at the time, if I can find the guy's name, decided to ban all of the Jews from the city of Rome. I have a note here. It says, at the commencement of the reign of Caesar Augustus, there were over 7,000 Jews in Rome. Though this is only the number that is said to have escorted the envoys there who came to demand the deposition of Archelaus. So there was a bunch of them there, up to 10% of the population, I'm reading. Now, in the 19 AD expulsion from Rome, there's different accounts on why that happened. I'll just read what this person wrote. The fact that the Jews had enjoyed a relatively peaceful existence in Rome prior to the 1st century AD makes the expulsion they experienced in the 1st century AD all the more puzzling. In the year 19, the Jews were expelled from the city of Rome. Both ancient writers and today's historians differ on exactly why the Jews were expelled from Rome. Some ancient writers claim the Jews were simply too good at winning converts, and Roman authorities worried that further spread of the Jewish religion would undermine state authority. Still others claim that the Jews were a continual source of civic unrest in the city, while yet another writer claims the Jews were expelled from Rome after a few Jewish men. Discounted here. I won't even read that. Discredited. What we do know about the 19 AD expulsion is that it was an expulsion more in name than in practice, and that Jewish religious practices were no way restricted. They were simply required to move outside of the bounds of the city. This expulsion, it should be noted, was strictly in regards to the city of Rome itself. Jews in other parts of the empire were largely unaffected. And then we had another expulsion. So some time goes by. This is 19 years. This is during Jesus' life. 19 AD. And then there was another one. And I have a longer account of this. I like this right up here. And I'm going to read the whole thing because this explained a lot of things to me. I think I'll read the whole thing for us. I got it off a website called International Christian Embassy Jerusalem. I don't know who these people are, what they stand for necessarily, but I found this gave some good context to what was happening with this expulsion from Rome. Priscilla and Aquila had been co-workers with Paul for a number of years. In the book of Acts, we meet this devout couple for the first time when Paul arrives in the Greek city of Corinth. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. This is written in Acts 18, 1 and 2. This is actually a text from Acts 18. And because he was of the same craft, it says, he abode there with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath. Synagogue here in Corinth. There's a lot of Jews. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. I'll keep reading on the article that I started. The couple helped Paul to establish a church in Corinth and moved on with him to Ephesus, where they remained actively involved in church planting alongside Paul. Like him, they were followers of Jesus of Jewish descent. In Acts, it is stated that they were forced to leave Rome because the emperor Claudius had expelled all the Jews from Rome. The Roman historian Suetonius confirms this event, and the early church historian Orosius gives the date as the year 49 AD. Others even place it as early as 41 AD. This expulsion was no isolated case. Only a few decades earlier, Tiberius had expelled all the Jews from Rome to the island of Sardinia. Suetonius explains that the expulsion came about because of the disturbances and riots among the Jews at the instigation of Crestus. Most church historians today agree that this refers to Christ. Christians were also frequently referred to as Christianoi. Apparently, there was an internal dispute among the Jewish residents of Rome over the messianic claims of Jesus, as had happened in Jerusalem, recorded in Acts 8:1, Acts 15:50, in Iconium and in Thessalonica and in Berea and elsewhere. But Claudius had little tolerance for their debate and expelled all the Jews. This included Priscilla and Aquila, who fled to Corinth, where they met up with Paul. For several years, they joined his ministry team, moving with him to Ephesus. But when a new emperor arose in Rome named Nero, he allowed the Jews to return in 54 AD. Priscilla and Aquila returned around this time, which is why Paul greets them at the end of the letter, at the end of Romans. So it goes on to say that with this expulsion of Jews in Rome, it's important to understand Paul's message to the church there. The church in Rome had existed long before Paul ever arrived there. Like other churches in those early decades of the movement, many of the congregants, undoubtedly, most of the teachers were Jewish. They were the most versed in the Holy Scriptures, which at the time consisted only of the writings of the Old Testament. Thus, when Claudius decided to expel the Jews from Rome, including those who believed in Jesus, this meant that the church in Rome was probably the first one entirely made up of Gentiles. The first church that was entirely made up of Gentiles was possibly because of these expulsions of the Jews from Rome. Remember that this Christian idea, this is a very Jewish thing. This was a Jewish Messiah coming to a Jewish people in a Jewish nation. This is a very Jewish thing. And we in the West, I think we sometimes miss that angle of it. Thus, when Claudius decided to expel the Jews from Rome, including those who believed in Jesus, this meant the church in Rome was probably the first one entirely made up of Gentiles. This must have presented a great challenge. All of the teachers and elders who instructed them every Sabbath were gone. Yet the Holy Spirit was also with them, and the Gentile believers managed to keep the church in Rome intact and growing on their own for a season. This likely brought a new sense of confidence as they discovered the church could still operate without the Jews. A few years later, we have Nero coming onto the scene. This is a different emperor now, who decided that it was all right, actually, for the Jews to be in Rome. So he allowed them back in. And that's the writer mentioned here that Aquilus and Priscilla, after that point, they returned to Rome. And now there's a short article. The writing continues talking about some of the tensions that this may have caused. Tensions with the church to Rome, with the return to Rome. But then Emperor Nero allowed the Jews to return, and no doubt tensions developed. Priscilla and Aquila are among those who came back to their home congregation, where they probably encountered a changed attitude towards them and their fellow Jewish believers. The historic context strongly suggests that Paul wrote to the church in Rome to set things in order and resolve the tensions between the new Gentile leadership and the returning Jewish congregants. For instance, we see Paul firmly admonishing the Gentiles not to forget their spiritual roots are in Judaism. This begins even in his initial greeting, where he reminds them that Jesus was born of the seed of David according to the flesh. But in chapter 2, he also advises the returning Jews to lead more through example than by words. And in chapter 14, he addresses questions regarding Jewish dietary laws, which seem to have arisen. Still, the main thrust of the letter is directed towards Gentile believers and their need to respect the Jewish roots of their faith. Paul stressed that the oracle, covenants, and redemptive purpose of God began centuries earlier with the Jewish people. In addition, he made clear that the Messiah was not a Roman citizen, but descended from King David's royal lineage. The Roman church found itself in a conflict between Jew and Gentile, from which it may never have recovered. Eventually, we find Priscilla and Aquila back in Ephesus, where Paul greets them again in 2 Timothy 4:19. Meanwhile, several decades later, the church at Rome, this is not my words, this is an author I found on the website, I said before, the church at Rome became the breeding ground for replacement theology as one of the greatest, I don't know if I should read this. I don't even know who this is. He calls somebody a heretic here who arose from the fellowship in Rome. I don't know who it is, so I'll leave that out.
this person said some of the books of the New Testament were too Jewish for him. And maintained that the God of the Old Testament was one of vengeance and wrath. His name is Marcion. I don't know who it is. I don't know anything about him. But he was expelled from the church and ended up taking large numbers of Gentile Christians with him. And these people write that the impact of his erroneous doctrines based on the rejection of our Jewish roots, because Israel largely rejected Jesus, is felt to this day. So I'll leave that to you. We can do with that what you want. I did not really think a lot about that last part.
Dennis, put your microphone down there. Let's have it stop working. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Hopefully it wasn't half an hour ago. During which the replacement theology. Okay. People say that replacement theology was born from this. And I think most of us know what replacement theology is from James's messages. So that's an attempt at answering the Jewish question, is why there's this large Jewish thread woven through here. J. Sidlow Baxter writes that, I'll just read what he wrote here. He says, the need for such a treatise is clear. When Paul wrote it, the gospel had been preached through the Roman world for a quarter of a century, and many communities of Christians had come into being. It was inevitable that the wide-spreading new faith should evoke momentous questions. What about the doctrine of God's righteousness if, as this new preaching says, sinners everywhere may be freely pardoned through grace? What about the relation of this gospel to the law of Moses? Does it not repudiate Moses? What about the Abrahamic covenant? How can the admission of Gentiles to equal privilege with Jews be reconciled with that? And what is going to become of morals if God is now going to deal with men on the ground of grace instead of holding them accountable to a righteous law? Will not people sin more than ever that grace may abound? And what about Israel's special covenant relation to God? Does not the new gospel imply that God has now cast off his people? To many a pious Jew, it would seem as though the new doctrine was flinging to the wind those heritages which were dearest and most vital. So too, many a new Christian convert, whether Jew or Gentile, would be perplexed by such questions. There was only one man equal to this crisis, capable of grasping it all in its breath, the situation, says Professor Finley. Enter Paul onto the scene. Paul was the perfect man for this task, wasn't he? C.A. Fox writes that many apparently opposite qualities went to make up the special fitness of Paul for this great life work. He combined his own unique experience, a personal connection of the closest kind, with the three principal social spheres of his age. He was called out of the very heart of Judaism. Jewish legalism, he knew it from end to end. He was called out of the very heart of Greek culture, for he lived his early life from infancy in one of the greatest centers of Hellenic life and was familiarized with all that was great and noble in Greek literature. He had, moreover, enjoyed from birth the varied privileges of Roman citizenship. He was thus a Hebrew to the backbone. He was Greek in the fullest sense of the term, and he was a Roman citizen freeborn. But besides all this, he united in his rare personality an unusual vigor of intellect, strength of will, depth of feeling, and sympathy. Intensity was the mark of his character. Whether intellectually or morally, let the one thing which surpassed all else in preparing him for his apostles yet to be mentioned. His sudden and miraculous conversion and call by the direct interposition of Christ himself, beyond all else, fitted him to compare together Judaism and Christianity with perfect fairness and enabled him to set the two systems side by side in vivid, startling contrast, as well as empowering him to testify how that Christianity, instead of being a violent antagonism and outrage upon pure Judaism, was the legitimate outcome, development, and completion of Old Testament truth. I know that was a lot of reading, but I hope you got the heart of what's behind that. So we have the growing Roman Empire, we have this migration, this exodus of Jews spreading around, settling in Rome, growing the church there. Then we have these expulsions of the Jews. They're coming back in. There's tensions growing. Paul writes his letter from Corinth to the church in Rome. And what do we have there? People call it Paul's magnum opus, the greatest or most important work of Paul. It's been called the profoundest piece of writing in existence. That's a strong label to put on something. The chief book of the New Testament, it's been called. It deserves to be known by heart, word for word, by every Christian, is what Luther said about it. It's a quick glance at the book of Romans. It could be broken down into three sections. We could call the first one, which is chapters 1 to 8, the sin problem. And then chapters 9 to 11, we could call that the Jew problem. This is J. Sidlow Baxter's labels on them. And 12 to 16, the life problem. So we have the first section, doctrinal. Then we have national, and then we have practical. And through the book of Romans, Paul systematically works through it like a great litigator in a court of law. So that is the backdrop. That is the zeitgeist, if you will, into which this letter was written. I trust that we will be edified in our studies through this over the next coming months and maybe years. It's probably not the most exciting thing we imagine to sit through 15 messages of theology, but I trust that God will feed us through that, that we'll grow thereby, that we'll find it interesting and encouraging and life-giving. So may God bless you. That is what I have for my introduction to the book of Romans.